lecture and discussion about the global movement against austerity. Again, at the Teresa Lang Community Center. This is a free event, but seating is limited, so please come on time.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
And the time is 7 o'clock, and you're listening to WBAI New York. It's time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. From Billy Bomb for the best, expect the worst.
Good evening, everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Mike.
Hello.
Voltaire.
Hi.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Hello, hello, I'm here.
Jim.
Hi.
And Bernie S. down in Philadelphia.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
Well, it's been, actually, this happened more than a week ago. We didn't have time to discuss it last week, but I believe Kyle made reference to it, the fact that a particular phone company is taking over another phone company. We've all seen this before. Phone companies constantly swallowing up their so-called competition and turning back into monopolies.
Wait, there's more than one phone company?
Well, not for long, apparently. The most recent one is AT&T supposedly swallowing up T-Mobile and creating, I guess, just one GSM company in the United States, because that would be so much easier for us to keep track of. And I'm a T-Mobile customer. Carl, you're an AT&T customer,
yeah.
And you've had no end of ribbing as far as saying that your company is taking over my company. But, you know, the whole thing seems to be a waste, because there's two different networks. They have antennas on the same poles in many places. And this is seen as something that's really bad for the consumer. But what I thought was particularly amazing is some of the news coverage I've been hearing about this. It focuses on Sprint Nextel. Yeah, that's the CDMA company, this Sprint Nextel. And they're upset about this. And to me, it's kind of hard to take a company seriously when they have dual names in their in their own name, and they're upset at a merger. So Sprint Nextel is upset that AT&T is going to be taking over T-Mobile. And they're urging the government to go and block this, maybe even have a class action lawsuit of some sort. Who knows? But the thing that upsets me about this is that everyone's talking about Sprint Nextel and their reaction to it, and whether or not people will sign on and support what Sprint Nextel is doing. It's not about Sprint Nextel. The only thing they care about is the fact that they're going to have some serious competition, and they won't make as much money as if there wasn't a huge GSM company, as opposed to two moderately sized GSM companies competing against them. I want to know who's standing up for the actual consumer, not another company that's protecting its profits, but where's the voice for the consumers? I have not heard that.
Lots of media reform groups like Free Press have done a really good job at
Yeah, well, where are they? I don't see them. They're not getting the press. They're not getting. They're not speaking loudly enough. I think that's always the problem, is that people don't speak loudly enough about this. But maybe more importantly, and Bernie, I think you can probably speak to this, why is this deal bad for consumers?
I think whenever you have fewer companies providing a similar product, you're going to have less competition. I've never been a T-Mobile customer, but you have, and they have some particularly innovative plans. They seem to be a little more adventurous as far as picking more innovative handsets, and they're the only mobile carrier I know of that gives you a rebate. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've read this to be true. If you fulfill your contractual service obligation, they actually lower your monthly price because then you're no longer paying to subsidize. They're no longer paying to subsidize the phone that you bought at a subsidized price. I think all the carriers should adopt that, but I think all these innovative policies that T-Mobile has are going to go out the window once AT&T absorbs them into the amoeba they are.
Well, I don't know anything about that particular deal. I've been a T-Mobile customer since, I haven't been a T-Mobile customer since the 90s. It started out with OmniPoint, which was America's first GSM company, and they were based in New Jersey. Then they were taken over by a company known as VoiceStream, and then VoiceStream turned into T-Mobile, and now apparently T-Mobile is going to turn right back into AT&T. But it's interesting because whenever I do call them, I don't have a contract with them, so I'm not quite sure what that's like to have a contract with them. I try to avoid these things. Whenever I do call them, they always there's an audible gasp on the phone when they realize how long I've been a customer and how early on in the game I got involved. And I think, Bernie, you get the same thing because you're a legacy Sprint customer, are you not?
Yes, I've been I was one of the first Sprint PCS subscribers in Philadelphia almost 15 years ago. And they also sort of gasp when I call them with a complaint, and I'm like, I've been a customer of yours for a decade and a half. Are you going to do something for me here? So yeah, it's pretty unusual these days. And I guess does it show up when you on your record when you call T-Mobile that you've been a customer through their predecessors?
Well, I know I get flashing red text by default when I call a phone company. This might be something else in addition that just says I've been there for a very long time. But you know, it's irrelevant to most people how long you've been a customer. The question is, are you going to get fair service? Are you going to be under some form of regulation? And here's the thing about wireless communications. And correct me if I'm wrong. There is no real regulation by government entities on them, is there?
No, the FCC doesn't regulate mobile carriers as common carriers like they do telephone local exchange carriers like Verizon. You don't want to confuse Verizon with Verizon Wireless. Likewise, you don't want to confuse AT&T with AT&T Wireless. They're distinctly different entities.
They are, but they are run by the same people in the end, are they not? I mean, I know they compete with each other somehow. All these different companies do that, but they are owned by the same people.
They're actually separate. Separate corporate entities.
They have the same damn name. The AT&T, Verizon. Come on,
yeah, Verizon. Verizon Wireless is only partly owned by Verizon.
Oh, right. Boy.
They're also owned by Vodafone and probably someone else as well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I have a feeling that it's all just one guy sitting in a room somewhere. But there's
his name is Mr. Burns.
There's a very complicated legal structure, and they all own bits and little pieces of each other.
Let's take a quick history lesson here from a site called I can't say this. Technologizer? Yeah, Technologizer, I think, is how you're supposed to say that.
Technologizer?
Okay, that's better. Technologizer. Yeah, okay. That rolls off the tongue easier. Here's a brief history of some of the things that have happened in phone companies over the years. Let's start in 1982. In January, AT&T ends a long-running antitrust suit by the U.S. Department of Justice by agreeing to break itself up into a national long-distance carrier and seven Baby Bells. The breakup is scheduled to happen in 1984. Who here can name the seven Baby Bells? Anyone? Hands? Nobody is in the studio is daring to do it. Bernie, how about you? You want to try?
The Baby Bells. There was Pacific Telesis. There was Bell Atlantic. There was Bell South. There was... Now, Mountain Bell was not one of them, was
no.
it?
No, Mountain Bell is one of the local companies.
Right, right, right.
Much
right.
like New York Telephone was a local company.
There was
company.
9X, who I used to work for.
Okay. In fact, you have a T-shirt that you wore at the First Hub called X9X.
Yeah, a bunch of us employees that we make using the 9X logo, we made it say X9X. What else? I think I only got about half of them.
Kyle?
Southwestern Bell and US West.
What about Ameritech?
Yep.
Okay, I lost track. We should be writing these down. There's Pacific Telesis. How do you say that?
Telesis.
All right. There was Southwestern, Bell. There was Ameritech, 9X, Bell Atlantic, Bell South. But that's only six. Where's the seventh one?
Is it Illinois?
You said Ameritech, didn't you?
Yeah, you added
Ameritech. I did say Ameritech.
But I think Ameritech was predates the original breakup.
No. Ameritech,
really?
I remember that was one of the crazy names they came up with. Yeah. Bell South, Southwestern Bell. I think there's U.S. West. That was it. The other one was
U.S.
West. Okay, so that's seven. Yeah, okay. Now, moving on. So we had those seven companies and AT&T providing long distance. Wasn't AT&T called American Bell for a little bit of time?
Yes.
Whatever happened to that?
It was sort of an interim name they used, and there was a big fight over whether they would... One of the things they didn't want to let go of, AT&T, was the Bell logo. They wanted to keep using that. And then I think eventually they told the Justice Department they'd be willing to give up the Bell logo, and they just called themselves AT&T. But that was during a period where they just were holding on tooth and nail to the Bell logo, you know, that picture of the Bell, which Tap Magazine infamously pictured with a crack in it. For a year or two, they were American Bell.
Oh, you know, I'm such an idiot. On the page I'm looking at, all seven of the companies are listed right there with their logos and everything. Yeah, there they are. Well, we got them right, at least. wow. And, of course, 9X. We've had discussions about this, what 9X stood for. Does anybody here in the studio know what 9X actually stood for? NYNEX? I know, Bernie, you know. You do know, right?
I know. I'll keep my mouth shut.
Keep your mouth shut. I think Kyle's going to give it a shot. Go ahead.
New York, New England Exchange.
No. But you got the New York, New England right.
Oh, man.
Anybody care to guess what the X stood for?
Executioners.
Very close, Rob. Very close, but no. Bernie, would you like to enlighten us?
Well,
I assumed you knew this. Oh, my goodness.
I used to know this when I worked for them, and now I forget, but it was...
all right. I'll give you a hint. It's rather poetic.
You're going to have to fill us in.
All right. The X stood for the unknown.
That's it.
The future.
What?
The future unknown. And I guess in 9X's case, the unknown was how long they were going to stay 9X. And they turned into Bell Atlantic. Then they turned into Verizon. And the saga just keeps going on.
Wait, then what was the difference between New York Telephone and 9X?
Ah, New York Telephone predated 9X. Actually, New York Telephone was a 9X company. 9X kind of took over the whole Northeast. And then eventually New York Telephone and New England Telephone, they all just became known collectively as 9X. So that's what happened there. You know, it was my idea, and I still think it's a good idea, that the country should break up into regions based on the Bell operating companies. So we would live in 9X, okay, and we'd get New York City, we'd get Boston, okay, we'd get Buffalo, but and Bernie, you'd be in Bell Atlantic, you would be Philadelphia and Washington D.C., I believe. The old CMP telephone, and then
Deacon of Potomac.
Yeah, and then, you know, other parts of the country, Ameritech, the Midwest, they'd get their own region, their own laws, their own way of doing things. I just think it would work better, you know. We'd have 9X high speed rail. Think of that. That'd be kind of cool.
So I would have to say to someone, I'm from New York, New England, and X stands for I don't know what.
You don't have to explain it every time. Did you explain why we're called America when there's only one country and two continents called America? No. There's no
I
point
usually
doing
say
that.
The states when I'm overseas.
The states of what?
The states.
There are all kinds of states.
Yeah, but only some of them are the states.
You think that we have a stranglehold on the word states?
Yes.
Lots of countries have states, you know.
No, most of them have provinces.
All right, we haven't even gotten to 1984 yet. In 1984, 2600 Magazine begins publishing. That's nice of them to say that. And the breakup takes place. AT&T's old local phone companies become Ameritech, Bell Atlantic, Bell South, 9X, Pacific Telesis. I never did pronounce that right. Southwestern Bell and U.S. West. GTE, an independent phone company with roots going back to 1918, spins off its GTE Sprint division and merges it with U.S. Telecom, which has roots going back to 1899. The merged company begins offering long-distance service in competition with AT&T under the name Sprint, which incidentally stands for?
Southern Pacific.
Don't tell us, Bernie. I know you know this, but anyone here? Testing the studio people. Wow.
Running really
you guys,
fast, but
you guys
not for very long.
Need to study your telephony history. And fortunately, there are courses ongoing in various hackerspaces around the world.
Well, we're getting one right now tonight.
What, a hackerspace?
Of course.
Oh. Oh, a lesson, yes. Yeah, I'm schooling everyone. I know that. Okay, Bernie, tell us what it stands for.
I want to give our listeners a clue. It was owned by the Southern Pacific Railroad Company, and railroads had something that most entities did not have, which was rights of way. Where are you going to run the lines? But they had rights of way along their railroad tracks going for, you know, through state, from state to state to state.
So in addition to trains, you could run wires.
Exactly. They actually, initially, they ran their own switching wires for the train signaling, and they thought, hey, we could use these wires and offer a competitive long distance service. Southern Pacific Railroad Southern Pacific Railroad Intelligent Telecommunications.
That's very close. I'll give it to you. Southern Pacific Railroad Intelligent Network of Telecommunications. They really tried hard to make it spell Sprint, I can tell. but it works, and the story you tell is true.
At least they're all words.
They are words. At least they're not making up words. Now, MCI was another company, and they had their roots back in the 1960s. And, Bernard, do you remember what MCI originally, how they started?
It was Microwave Communications Incorporated.
Right. They basically communicated with microwaves, but they communicated only between a couple of places.
Yeah, it was just wherever it was, I think it was like Chicago and some other place, wherever it was really expensive to make two calls between two cities,
mm-hmm.
and they thought, hey, we can bypass AT&T and offer a lower rate to our customers. There were no competitive long-distance providers. They were like the first one.
Right.
And so they set up basically a microwave link. They set up towers, and they beamed the signals via microwave. Now, AT&T did that, too. They used microwave to these big cornucopia horns you'd used to see up on towers, shooting, you know, usually in the 4 gigahertz.
Yeah, you'd see them on the interstate everywhere.
Yeah, you still do. Going out of Pennsylvania on our way to the Dayton Hamvention, you still see a few of them standing. But anyway, it's all underground fiber optic now for the most part. But they set up this they set up this microwave link between two cities that were, it just turned out to be expensive to call between these two cities.
I think it was Cleveland and Chicago.
I think you're right.
And apparently a lot of people like to talk between those two cities, so a company actually was formed called MCI in the 60s just for that purpose.
And AT&T sued them mercilessly because they viewed that as really, and it was a famous, I think it went all the way to the Supreme Court that they were allowed to do that. And once MCI succeeded, all these other companies like Sprint jumped into the marketplace.
All right, so now you have 1984. Sprint has come into being, competing with AT&T for long distance. Wireless phone company Fleet Call is founded. Does anybody know what it changed its name to in 1993? Bernie?
I think they wanted to get away from the whole Anima thing.
Yeah, it wasn't doing much for customers. No clue?
Fleet.
All right, they changed their name to Nextel. 1993,
oh, right.
Yeah. And then SBC, Southwestern Bell. SBC is Southwestern Bell. They acquired Cellular One, which was the cellular business of Metromedia. Now we move to 1988. Pacific Northwest Cellular is founded. It later changes its name to anyone? Wow, it's a good thing this isn't Jeopardy, because it would be an embarrassment. VoiceStream, yes. VoiceStream, and of course, VoiceStream later took over OmniPoint. Now, also in 1988, AT&T acquired wireless pioneer McCaw Cellular, joint owner with Southwestern Bell of the Cellular One brand name, and began using the AT&T name rather than Cellular One, but Southwestern Bell continued to use the Cellular One name. And everybody, that is so complicated and convoluted. Pacific Telesis spins off its wireless services into a company called AirTouch. Southwestern Bell changes its name to SBC. And in the first major reversal of the Bell breakup, Bell Atlantic acquired 9X. And that was the end of 9X. Then SBC acquired Pacific Telesis.
So what year were you?
I know. Did this all happen in 1988? Because that's the last year that was listed on this piece of paper here. So I think we're still at 1998. WorldCom, a long-distance company with roots dating to 1983, acquired MCI, which went back to 1963, and they formed MCI WorldCom. SBC then continued to acquire things. They acquired Ameritech. AirTouch merged with Vodafone of the UK to form Vodafone AirTouch. And, you know, I think... Oh, I'm sorry. The numbers... they moved them to the right of the graphic. Okay, so Yeah, all right. We're up to 1994 was when AT&T acquired Macaw Cellular and Pacific Telesis created AirTouch. 1995,
Nine?
Southwestern Bell changed its name to SBC. 1996 was when Bell Atlantic acquired 9X. 97, SBC acquiring Pacific Telesis. WorldCom starting. 1999, SBC acquired Ameritech. And AirTouch merged with Vodafone of the UK to form Vodafone AirTouch. We're up to 2000 now. Quest, founded in 1996, acquired US West. Vodafone AirTouch and Bell Atlantic formed a joint venture called Verizon Wireless.
Is there like an animation of like Pac-Man eating each other or something?
There should be. Somebody should make this.
It's very hard to follow.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, there won't be any more questions after we go through this. But also in 2000, Bell Atlantic merged with GTE to form Verizon. Yeah. 2001, SBC and Bell South combined their wireless business into a company called? Bernie?
Singular.
Very good, yes. spelled with a C. And in 2002, AT&T, which had been trying to turn itself into a long-distance wireless cable mega conglomerate, spun off its wireless business to form AT&T Wireless Services. German telecommunication giant Deutsche Telekom, which had acquired VoiceStream in 2001, changed the U.S. operations name to T-Mobile. 2003, WiMAX provider Clearwire is founded, and after a massive accounting scandal, WorldCom changed its name to MCI. 2004, Singular acquired AT&T Wireless. Quest, which had offered its own wireless service, sells off its assets and became a reseller for Sprint. In 2008, it switched to Verizon Wireless. It continues to offer landline service, but it's no longer listed in this list for some reason. In 2005, Sprint bought Nextel to form Sprint Nextel. SBC acquired AT&T and adopted its name. Verizon acquired MCI. 2006, AT&T acquired Bell South and renamed the latter's Singular wireless service to AT&T. 2008, Sprint Nextel's wireless broadband unit, I don't know how to pronounce this, XOHM. How do you pronounce that?
Zome, I think they pronounced it.
Zome, okay. Merges with Clearwire, giving Sprint 54% ownership of the combined company. Clearwire is still in business. 2011, AT&T agreed to buy T-Mobile US from Deutsche Telekom in a deal expected to close next year. And again, that's all from technologizer.com. Nice little history that was put on there.
The manual's neat, that website actually shows a lot of the old logos.
It does. And I should say Harry McCracken wrote this, and it's really 1982 to 2011, A History of Phone Companies. It's scary. It really is. And I think it's not good that that we're getting less choice.
Yeah, it's like following a soap opera that's been going on for 50 years, and you just start watching it, but. It's really interesting, though, how it was important enough for them to break all this up 30-odd years ago. And that's when these companies were basically just controlling telephone communications and maybe a couple other things here and there, but still basically telephone companies. Now that all these little companies have gone through all these sort of changes and puberties and what have you, they're controlling so much more. They're, you know, major telecom giants, and they're being absorbed back into each other again. And is it not important now for some reason to make sure they stay apart?
Yeah, it's
more important now.
It is. I think it is. Anyway, that's our look at telecommunication giants for this week. Now, over in Japan, there have been a couple of stories about this that have moved in various wire services about people resorting to old means of communication to keep informed. In a technology-crazed nation, where many people were glued to cell phones, accustomed to the internet's nearly instantaneous access to information, being cut off has been disorienting and frightening. Local governments in the hardest hit areas, desperate to reach residents with important emergency information, have reached into the past for more tried and true means of communication, including radios, newspapers, even human messengers. When cell phones went down, there was paralysis and panics at the head of emergency communications at Miyako's City Hall, where the tsunami filled the first floor with foul-smelling mud. Everyone was running around asking, what happened to the nuclear plant? What happened to our town? And throughout the country, people have turned to low-tech alternatives in their sometimes frantic search for news of loved ones in quake-affected areas. They've posted notices on bulletin boards, recorded tearful pleas on television. Tokyo's cell phone service was restored, much of Miyako remained cut off from cell phones and the internet. So they had to resort to radio as the most reliable medium to get information to survivors scattered over a wide area. Within a week of the earthquake, a group of residents got permission from the city to create a small emergency radio station, Miyako Disaster FM, which began broadcasting last Tuesday from what had been an unused room in a building run by the National Farm Cooperative. They equipped it with a few microphones and a folding table and a transmitter whose signals reach up to 9 miles. It's amazing that low-power FM, again, is proving to be the savior as far as reaching people and letting people know what the latest news is. And, yeah, I guess really quickly our technology falls apart when things like this happen, and you need those old-fashioned means of communication.
Tried and true.
Yeah, absolutely. So think about that when you listen to the radio, that it's all about local communications.
I think it's interesting that in light of what we were just talking about with cell phones, which are essentially regulated like toys almost. It's not a utility the way like landline services were, and there's no guarantee that it's going to work quite the way a landline is guaranteed as a utility. So it's in an emergency, all that stuff goes down, and people are sort of wondering, you know, how they're going to communicate, and they're left with really, they're sort of left out to dry, or, you know, with no resources. And they pay for that service. They pay for their service to not work when they really need it. And like what we were talking about with our friend in Japan,
Stuart. Yeah,
Stuart. Yes, he was talking about just data working, and like SMS wasn't even working. Which in previous years, I think we've talked about as SMS being sort of reliable in emergencies.
And you don't know when SMS doesn't work because it doesn't bounce. You don't get a bounce message.
So right.
You assume it went through, and lots of times it doesn't.
Right.
I don't understand why people don't keep landlines, because they're so much more dependable. Obviously, when all the telephone poles are knocked over, they're not quite as dependable. But oftentimes, almost every time I've lost power, I've kept my phone line.
Yeah.
But if you have a phone line that's hooked up to your power through cable or through VoIP or something like that,
right,
and it's not backed up, it doesn't have a power supply going that'll keep it up during a power outage, you're going to lose everything. You're going to lose all your communications.
Yeah.
And it just seems like not very smart. If you want to stay in touch with people, these things fall apart a lot quicker than you might think.
Yeah, and again, it's sort of experimental still. Like it's essentially a really nifty toy, but it's so fragile when, you know, real world stuff starts happening. And you know, with copper, it just was never it was never a doubt that you would still have those batteries running that network and stuff. So here they are back with selling us all these fancy toys, and they're completely unregulated the way utilities, like telephone utilities, were back in the day. I don't know that would make the wireless service any better, but you know, we're paying for basically something that isn't really guaranteed to work.
Yeah, and there's just this tendency in I think our society nowadays to just try and upgrade and find the next shinier thing and the bigger, better thing. I mean, analog TV in this country is pretty much dead. We've got all these new flashy things, and there are houses now where they don't own a radio. And you know, that used to be there used to be a radio in every house, and it was something dependable. It was something you always knew was going to just work.
Yeah, yeah, it's sad.
I don't own a radio.
You see?
Or a landline telephone.
Yeah, this is it. Mike, you personify what's going on in this country.
No.
Yeah, you're the trendsetter here. And
but next time the tsunami hits, let me know how your landline holds up.
Well, you know what? I'll bet my landline will hold up a lot better than your non-radio will hold up.
I don't know how to compare those two things.
I'm just saying, if you don't have the technology in the first place, then you know, you're at a disadvantage because it won't be there. If it works, or you know, the things that hold up to storms, to power outages, I think that they've proven themselves already, and they're things we should rely on until they get replaced by something as reliable.
I think we can only hope that they're learning a lot from these kinds of things, and as customers of these kinds of companies, we can hope and encourage them to come up with ways to deal with stuff.
You know, I'd like to say they're learning.
And I think citizens dealing with these kinds of emergencies are learning themselves about ways they can like set up a low power FM station. They're saying, hey, you know, I can't depend on this.
Right.
So here we are again, people sort of hacking together ways of dealing with adverse circumstances. So
I'd like to see
everybody's
us,
learning.
I'd like to see us learn that local radio is important, that it's important to have live people in radio stations like we have here at WBAI.
Absolutely.
I don't see that happening. I see corporate interests taking over and basically farming out music boxes everywhere and having as little local content as possible. I see the way people are treating the nuclear disaster, saying, well, they can't happen here. It's not as dangerous as you think it is. And just simply closing their eyes to what is actually going on when you have radiation levels tens of thousands of times the normal level, and people are comparing it to eating a banana and standing next to a human, things like that. It's silly. Obviously, there's a major issue here. Obviously, there are things that are completely unsafe and should never have happened in the first place. And we don't learn anything by being stubborn and saying, well, our way is better and it could never happen here, because it could happen anywhere and it will. Okay, I didn't mean to get so dark there, but let's move back into the humorous part of technology reporting. Bernie, you posted this story to the list, and I believe you said, there are so many things wrong with this reporting, I don't know where to start. It's an Associated Press story about tougher penalties for hackers. And you also pointed out that the story seems to be run in different newspapers and chopped down. And when it's chopped down, it makes even less sense. What I'm going to do is read one of the longer stories that was on the Associated Press. And you just jump in and stop me anytime I say anything that doesn't make a lot of sense or that is just wrong. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Bill seeks tougher penalty for hackers. Are we okay with the headline at least?
Okay.
By Michelle Rindels, the Associated Press. Presumably she got her name right. Embarrassing messages sent to friends and clients. I have a problem right there. As an English major, I'm sorry, but that's not a sentence. It's certainly not a leading sentence. Michelle, you should be embarrassed, ashamed of yourself there. That's not how you start a story.
Wait, there's a period and not a comma after that?
Yeah, period. Embarrassing messages sent to friends and clients. How about, Michelle, embarrassing story written with your name on it? That's a good way to start that. Prank phone calls. That's another sentence. Michelle got another sentence, a three-word sentence. Prank phone calls. Yeah. And the final sentence, threats texted to his girlfriend. First of all, who is his? All right? I mean, you haven't even defined who your leading character is here. Don't ever write a novel, because that's not how you do it.
Wait, it's building suspense. That's how you write a novel. Maybe not how you write a news story, but it's how you write a novel.
Yeah, the first paragraph of a news story is not supposed to contain mystery. It's supposed to contain facts.
That's but you said it's not how you write a novel. It is how you write a novel.
I think this author has a
great career in novel writing.
Fine.
Ahead of her.
Well, then she can write novels, but she should stop writing for the Associated Press based on this first paragraph. And Bernie, I really thought you'd have more problems with this than me, but we haven't even gotten into what the story is about yet, so let's try that. A Las Vegas man shared a laundry list of modern technological terrors with state senators Friday, telling them about what a woman did after she felt scorned following a date with him.
Okay.
All right. And here's a quote. There are not words to describe how violated you feel, Jeff Crampton said. I live afraid of the next time it will happen.
Okay.
A Nevada Senate committee was considering a bill that would raise the penalty for illegally gaining access into a computer, also known as hacking. Oh, you have a problem with that, Bernie? Tell us what's not factual about that statement.
Illegally gaining access to a computer is not necessarily hacking.
Well,
I mean, it could be trespassing. It could be. I mean, there's so many different ways you could describe illegally gaining access to a computer. Hacking means a lot of things. You know, driving away from a bank where you just stole money could either be called driving or, you know, fleeing a bank robbery. And they're just using a too general a term to describe a specific thing.
Okay. All right. Well, that is a problem with the story. Measure SB 376, sponsored by Senator Barbara Sagavsky. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right at all, a Republican from Las Vegas, and 14 other lawmakers would charge hacking as a low-level felony carrying a longer prison term and a fine instead of a misdemeanor. The misdemeanor sentence currently in state law allows for up to 6 months in prison and a fine of up to $1,000. All right, well, she's not doing too badly. You haven't objected to anything she said so far, other than the one thing. Crampton said the alleged hacker broke into his email and sent embarrassing messages to his contacts list. She made prank calls and sent threatening text messages to his girlfriend, Crampton said.
Wait. She sent messages to his contact list? You mean to people in his contact list or to his list?
She sent embarrassing messages to his list, so I imagine that encompasses people.
Really? This is the objection you have?
Well, that's just grammatical, but there's yeah. like bigger parts wrong with the story.
Yeah, well, let's get to them already.
All right. She made prank calls and sent threatening text messages to his girlfriend, Crampton said, and then used the girlfriend's email account to send emails to his clients, telling them not to trust him in major business deals. When she was told she could be put in jail, she allegedly said, not in the state of Nevada. The proposed legislation would carry a prison term of 1 to 4 years and a fine of up to $5,000. Misdemeanor crimes are rarely prosecuted, Sagavsky said. This gets the offender's attention. We're almost at the end of the story, Bernie. You haven't objected to very much.
I think she's going to wrap it up with a doozy here. All right, so let's hear it.
Hopefully. Hacking includes... Yeah, you're right. Hacking includes willfully interfering with a computer network or communications device, or do you want to object as I go along and wait for the sentence to end?
I'll just stop. I'll wait till the sentence is end, but okay. I'm going to say at the end of it.
Yeah, sure. Don't do that. But with this writer, you never know where the sentence is going to end. Or locking someone out of their computer or device. Okay. I think we all see where the problem is there. A stricter penalty applies if the hacking interrupts a government computer system, causes injury, or commits fraud.
Okay.
And the last paragraph here, Chuck Calloway of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department said investigations for such crimes often take months. He supported the stronger punishments in the proposal, saying police don't like to expend many resources on hacking crimes when the existing penalty is so small.
That, I have a problem with that there. That like the whole, it's not a problem with the story, but with that methodology.
With what Chuck said, you have a problem with that?
Yeah, like whenever police don't like to expend resources on a law enforcement issue when the existing penalty is so small, like what do they, apparently they get like commission points for prosecuting people for more serious crimes than I just don't buy that whole concept of law enforcement, that if this crime doesn't have a strong penalty, they're not going to bother enforcing it. Well, first of all, a lot of penalties are way out of the box, stronger than they should be, as in most hacking related statutes. But it seems like if they want to prosecute these offenses, they should really go after serious activity instead of just making not so serious activity have a really harsh sentence and then make it worth their while to prosecute. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Okay, well that's what's coming out of Nevada. New hacking regulations, quote unquote. We have some letters to read from our listeners. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. You can also call us, 212-209-2900. We'll be taking phone calls in just a couple of minutes. This letter comes from, who does this come from? From Owen. Hi there. In my two most recent addresses/phone numbers, I received communications intended for previous occupants. This is based on last week's show where we played some of Kyle's famous voicemail messages to strange people. I used to have his phone number. These have been from debt collection agencies and have on occasion been quite threatening. Some recorded messages have informed me that bailiffs or thugs licensed to seize debtors' property had been dispatched and were en route to my home. I recently had what appeared to be a handwritten card put through my letterbox, which was designed to look like a notification of a missed delivery. In extremely small print on the reverse side was the name of a company, which a little investigation through the UK's company's registrar turned out to be a wholly owned subsidiary of a large collections agency. The company mentioned on the card was simply a front to obscure the debt collector lurking in the background. I can only assume that this was intended to get me to call the company to confirm whether the debtor was still residing at the address on their records. I think it's funny how companies can use these social engineering techniques while private citizens are discouraged from employing similar tactics. Well, we're all discouraged from using them because they work. Social engineering is one of the most successful ways of getting information, and it's basically the art of convincing people to tell you things that they really shouldn't be telling you. And we like to play around with that a lot as hackers.
It's also one of the most reliable methods. No matter where the technology goes, no matter how many fancy protections you can put on technical measures, it's still, you're always going to be able to lie to somebody and convince them that you're telling the truth.
And Austin writes in to say, not the whole city, the person, writes in to say we were making fun of Kyle's voicemail system last week. One of the commands was resave, and he says that resave is for born-again Christians who have OCD. Thank you, Austin, for that. That's, always good to have things explained to us. Drew writes in, I was surprised to hear the Newcastle Maker Faire mentioned on the show last week. I hail from Newcastle, England. I was in attendance with my son at the Maker Faire. It was a really good turnout with some great showcases of technology, and looks as though it's going to get bigger year on year. If you're ever in England at the beginning of March next year, I would recommend going. It's great to see the hacker community coming together, having fun, showing the general public the side of hacking they don't hear about in the mainstream media. Keep up the good work on the show and the magazine. Bringing it to Kindle is a great idea. It's in the top 10 magazines here in the UK. And thanks, Drew, for that that kind letter. Speaking of the Kindle, we're coming out on the Kindle again on Friday. The next issue of 2600, April 1st, no fooling, coming out on the Kindle this week on Friday.
Are you sure you're not going to switch it with an issue of Tap?
Why would I do that?
For April Fool's.
Yeah, that's... That's a good idea, but no, no, you don't have April Fools on the Kindle. I think that would just confuse people because they're confused enough as it is. And you know, I should probably take this moment to address a couple of issues that we've been having with Kindle subscriptions. It's going great. I mean, it's mushroomed into something much bigger than we ever thought it would be. But you know, actually, it mushroomed a lot bigger even than that a few weeks ago, where our subscriptions actually doubled in a couple of days. And after about 10 days, the Kindle people quietly just took them all back. It was some kind of accounting error. This is what we have to deal with. These are the kind of things that happen. They're new to this. And I'm not being disparaging by saying this. It's basically, this is a new venture for Amazon, for Kindle. And a lot of people write to us and say, how come you're not on the iPad? How come I can't read you on the Nook? And there are a number of reasons for this. For one thing, Amazon and Apple simply have conflicts, they have problems, and they don't agree on how to distribute each other's material. And the problem is that Amazon Books or Kindle Books are different people than Kindle magazines and blogs and things like that. They use different formatting completely, and they simply have not worked out a plan yet to have Kindle magazines available on the iPad. Now, it works on Android devices. It does not work on anything Apple-related. Now, we've addressed this issue pretty thoroughly in the next issue, which if you do have a Kindle or have eyes and can go to a bookstore and pick it up there, you can find out what we're talking about as far as that goes. It's something that if it's not resolved by the next issue, we're going to figure something else out as far as just getting it to people with iPads. We're trying everything we can. I know people get angry at us because they think we're the ones. In fact, on the Amazon site, it says that it's a publisher restriction. It's not. It's an Amazon restriction, and it's something that we're fighting to get changed so that everybody has DRM-free editions on whatever platform they choose.
When can I buy this without in an open format without DRM?
You can. You can.
I can't.
Well, you can when you have a Kindle.
Doesn't say open format to me, something I can only read on one particular hardware device.
Yeah, well, these conflicts have to be... See, the problem is, if we were to suddenly allow it to be distributed on the iPad through some other source, went to the Apple store...
I have no interest in iPad. I just want to read it on my computer.
Yeah, well, there are all these different formats. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy to get them just right for every single format out there. But Amazon has these little rules that you have to provide it to them at the lowest price, and if anybody provides it at a lower price, they cut your payments in half. And it's really kind of crippling when they do things like this. It's anti-competitive. We're arguing about this. We're trying to get it fixed. We're trying to make it so that everybody can read this on the platform of their choice. Kyle.
Well, and part of it is that Amazon's got a really popular platform. That's where all the customers are. That's mm-hmm. where all the people are that want to buy an electronic format of a magazine or a book. And so we're sort of learning about their rules and what it takes to participate in that market and provide that base, that audience, a product. And it is work to mm-hmm. get things into the right formats and stuff. And if we were to just like put out, you know, a text file of it, you know, that work would basically be sort of a volunteer thing, and it takes energy to get things in the right format right. and make them available, even just converting them and getting them out.
That's why you don't see other issues dealing with this kind of. You don't see other magazines that do this because of the amount of work it does take to do this in the first place.
I pay for PDFs as often as I can.
Well, you can You'd be pleased to know we have the PDFs of Volume 26 available for free, DRM-free is what I'm trying to say. And Volume 27, which is 2010, will be available fairly soon as well. That is the most we can do right now under the current way the whole system works without antagonizing companies and penalizing ourselves. But we're fighting this. We're trying. We're trying to make it available to as many people as possible, DRM-free, worldwide. That is our goal. There's no reason why we wouldn't want to do that. And what we've learned so far from the steps we've taken is that electronic publishing is a really good thing to be involved in. And it's foolish for any publication not to take those steps or to try to keep things restricted. But they make it hard. They make it really difficult for you to set things your way, to basically have it so that your audience can benefit. You have to play by their rules or you wind up paying a penalty.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's like we're sort of like learning and playing their game to see what the boundaries of it are, what it takes to actually be involved in that marketplace. And if we can change some of these things that we're like concerned about, maybe we can start looking at other options as well. But even Amazon's aware of that possibility of other devices and other ways of distributing electronically, and they're very hostile to if you were to provide it at a lower cost or this, that, or the other thing. And right now, because Amazon is so popular, it's like if you're not playing in their little sandbox, then you're not really a part of that electronic market. I mean, they're it. There's not anybody that has as much product and are as popular and big as the Kindle.
One thing we're trying to do is address the issue directly on the Kindle. If you subscribe to 2600 via Kindle, there's a special section in there just for people that get that particular type of electronic edition where these issues are talked about directly. For instance, this is fascinating. You know, if you use the less than sign anywhere in an article for Kindle magazines, it gets obliterated. We have to write to them, and it's a lot of back and forth emails to get them to put the less than sign in the article again. Apparently, they think, or they just don't know any other way to do it, they think that publishers are going to try and take over their system by issuing all kinds of HTML commands and taking over. I don't know what they think we're capable of doing, but that's just one little hurdle that we have to constantly watch out for. And these are growing pains. We know that it's not optimal yet, but we're getting there. We're trying, and we're trying to have an open dialogue with people on the subject. And we've gotten so much support. You know, we're number one in customer service. That's amazing. I never expected that. We were outselling Forbes magazine for a while and Fortune and things like that, not on the newsstands, but in Kindle. I mean, these kinds of things, they tell me that there are a lot of people out there interested in what we're doing and willing to support the efforts. So there's nothing we don't want to try. Let's put it that way.
Manuel.
Yes, go ahead, Bernie.
Do you remember when the early days of the Apple podcast, we were rated on Apple's website off the hook as the radio show off the hook, is it was like number 8 or something. It was crazy high on the list initially. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I did. That didn't last very long though.
No, but it was interesting being, you know, in the top ranking of everything that people were downloading to their iPods as far as you know, streaming.
Right.
You know.
Right, definitely. I mean, it didn't last long because so many other things popped up. Right now on the Kindle, there are less than 100 magazines total that are being offered, which is probably the reason why we're so high up on the list and are getting a lot of attention that way. And that just says something about publishers not being willing to take a chance. They're worried about, well, if I put it there, everyone's going to copy it and we won't make any money. Yeah, there might be some of that, but there are a lot of people who do support what it is that you're all about and are willing to, as Mike said, pay for PDFs or pay for some kind of electronic publishing. You got to embrace technology sometimes and try and shape things to your liking rather than avoid the realities, the inevitable. This is something that the record companies, the motion picture industry, they're very good at avoiding what's obvious, the writing on the wall, what everybody sees, and that's why they're so hostile to change and to the consumer in the end.
Well, and now when an industry is in its infancy, like the ebook publishing industry is now is the time when you can affect things and I think make lasting changes. Whereas if they got set in some ways that didn't work well for the consumers or for the publishers, it would be much harder to change it further down the line.
Exactly. With less than 100 magazines out there and with a special section devoted to Kindle readers, you better believe your words are going to be read by people shaping the industry. So that's just, it's a great way to get involved now while it's relatively in its infancy. So yeah, coming out on the Kindle, second issue in our subscription experiment this Friday. And of course, the real printed issue is coming out right around the same time as well. Mike.
Do we have a minute to discuss this privacy story out of Germany? I know we have
We only have 5 minutes to take phone calls. Make it quick.
But the story is really kind of fascinating. There's a German politician. He's with the Green Party called Maltus Spitz, and he sued T-Mobile, which is a German company, to get his location records for his cell phone. And Site Online published this, and they have this great interactive map. You can go; they translate it into English. You can see everywhere he went for 6 months. You can see when he leaves the country. You see him go to the airport, and then he disappears till he gets back. And so they published this, and then the New York Times picked it up and published this story called "It's Tracking Your Every Move, and You May Not Even Know," about how basically you have no privacy on the phone. And then the Congress picked it up. Representatives Markey and Barton, who are the co-chairs of the Congressional Bipartisan Privacy Caucus, wrote to the four U.S. telecom carriers asking them. There's a total of 7 questions they were asked, and they have 15 days to respond, saying, like, do you care at all for your users' privacy? And so there's really very little technically new here that that listeners of our show wouldn't already be aware of, but it's great that someone finally is taking an interest.
Well, basically, tell me if I'm wrong here. It's somebody saying that while their cell phone is on, it's able to pinpoint their location.
Right. And Germany had this law called data retention, where, in fact, the carriers were required by law to maintain those records for 6 months. Mm-hmm. We don't have that in the United States, but we also don't have in the United States is any idea whatsoever of if they're retaining it, what they do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we'll get some clarity.
I have to assume that they're doing that, that as long as I have a cell phone on my person that is turned on, that my whereabouts can be tracked if that cell phone can be attached to me. There's no reason why you have to have a cell phone that has your real name on it. You can trade it with a friend. You can confuse the authorities in all sorts of ways if that's really how you want to fight the system. But this is nothing that surprises me. And as you said, I don't think it surprises many of our listeners.
No, well, I think people who are paying attention have been aware of this for a long time. But it's good to see that more people are paying attention now.
All right. Hopefully something can be done about it. Rob?
Yeah. The fact that the New York Times and Congress are now taking an interest in it, that's what surprises me.
Yeah, I mean, haven't we been saying this for almost decades now? Okay, well, at least it's got their attention finally.
Manuel,
let's take a phone call. Go ahead, Bernie, quickly.
I just want to say real quick, our congressional representatives are trying to enact legislation that would limit how mobile carriers could use this tracking data commercially. I'm more concerned about how our government is going to use this tracking data, and there's mm-hmm. no proposed legislation along those lines.
Yeah, well, governments often don't pass legislation limiting what they do. Okay, 212-209-2900. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak
hey,
up.
What
yeah, what's
what
on
up?
Your mind? Go ahead.
Let's see. I'd like to mention
Rebel. Please. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
I said, Governor, what does 2600 mean?
It means to go on to the next phone call if it had a say in the matter. Let's go over here. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
All right. I'd like to mention when you...
Okay, Rebel, you are banned from calling now. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
When is the DRM issue is going to be available for my Commodore 64?
Good evening to you too, sir. Thank you for that question. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
Good. Emmanuel, it's me, Jake. I met you at the store the other day in a parking lot.
Oh, hey. Yeah, we meet listeners in parking lots all the time. And
yeah,
it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, good. I'm glad. I'm actually in Nassau County doing some work for the BP.
Yeah, you work for Verizon Wireless, we found out.
I most certainly do. Yes, I do.
I don't know if you heard our history of the various phone companies before.
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact. And you should have seen me. It was the greatest. It was great. I actually stopped working and listened. For a while. There's a lot of things I didn't know.
Well, if we were able to get phone workers all around the world to stop working while we were on the air, then we've accomplished what we set out to do.
There you go.
So what's on your mind?
A couple things real quick. Do you guys remember the name of I think it was an Israeli company. I think they started out here in the late 90s, but they folded up like real fast. I can't think of the name of it. I think they're right around the same time that satellite cell phone company was around. Well, satellite portable phone company started up.
What did the Israeli company do?
Geotech. Yeah. That's it. Geotech. That's what I was thinking of.
Okay.
They actually started tried to start a network too, and it was weird because what they did, they had sites where we have our sites, and when they folded up, they just left everything. They left loads and loads of really nice HP and Agilent wasn't then, but test equipment in their sites and stuff. It was actually a mass exodus.
Interesting.
They were going to be another cell phone company. And the other thing is, I wanted to mention, did you guys see, I might have missed this, the other day, was something in the newspaper about the authorities wanting to make it harder to track pay-as-you-go cell phones.
I did not see that myself. But
they want to make it harder?
It was either Newsday or the Daily News. I forget what it was.
Do you mean they want to make it easier?
They want to make it a lot easier. They want to make it easier.
Okay, yeah, that makes more sense.
Yeah. I was wondering if you guys had heard anything about that. I know I didn't hear any comments.
That's kind of an ongoing thing, so I didn't hear that specific story, but it doesn't surprise me that kind of thing is going on.
Yeah, it was in the news today.
All right, listen, we're kind of out of time now, but great running into you and great talking on the phone.
And Jake, definitely, if you see T-Mobile leaving any equipment behind, let us know so that we can collect it for our phone company.
Yeah,
I'll do that. We'll see. I run into those guys all the time. We'll see what happens.
All right. I'm sorry we didn't get to take more phone calls, but we had a lot to talk about tonight. And thanks to all listeners who did call in. Thanks to all of those calling in now. I'm sorry we can't get to you. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Next week, we'll try and take some more phone calls. And until then, stay technically savvy. Oh, Rob, you want to say that there's 2600 meetings this Friday?
Yes, there's 2600 meetings this Friday.
Well, good for you. Okay, well, be sure to attend on April Fool's Day. Good night.
Yes, Brazil. Hey.